So before we begin with the questions, why don't we begin with our scripture? Three beautiful scripture passages that I think, I was going to say that may or may not have to do with what we're going to be talking about, but they do. I know that at least two of them do, because they have to do with seeking and having an open heart, having an open mind. And so why don't we read these passages together, because they're so beautiful. This one from Micah, by the way, many people quote it because it kind of says it all in terms of, you know, what are we about? What are we here to do? And who are we to be as human beings? So, what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? And then from Jeremiah, you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. And from John, Pilate said to Jesus, "What is truth?" After he said this, he went out to the people again and told them, "I find no crime in him." And then I'm just going to butt in because this is my little commentary here in the brackets, okay? And we can read this together, but I just wanted to clarify what's scripture and what's commentary. So, but we notice that while Pilate said, not asked, he did not stick around for even a reply, and definitely not long enough to seek, hear, consider, or discover what that truth was. Yes. So, may we be seekers, but finders as well, right? All right, so we're gonna set our timers. I hope this does service to these questions. We actually set a, we ended up deciding to set a 5-minute time limit because some of these questions in the past, you know, they have to do with life and death and struggling and suffering and so forth, and we can easily, you know, you can write books about these things. Sometimes I think this is the third, maybe the fourth time that we've done this, and sometimes we get to two questions, we thought that was a little unfair, so we thought we would shorten the time, maximize the questions.
Ding, and ding, your time's up.
Sorry. Here we go, and that was my 5 minutes. So, Laura, I defer to you.
Just kidding, Paul. Actually, we're going to beat our record because I'm going to give these first two questions together in combination, because they work together. So does one pray to God or Jesus? Mm-hmm. And how do you have conversations with God? So does one pray to God or Jesus? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, whichever one works for you, God or Jesus. Jesus is the human pathway to God, so a lot of people feel very comfortable talking with Jesus in that way. And then other people have a little harder time understanding the greater nature of Jesus and prefer to speak directly to God. So, how do you have conversations with God? Hello, God, it's me, Laura. Mm-hmm. And just talk with God. The great thing about God, my point of view, is God, Jesus are always with us, always listening, know what's going on in our consciousness. We are one of one consciousness there. And so the praying is for us, not for God. So it's our communication with God. And then we hang on a little bit and wait for that answer to come. And that answer comes in multiple different ways. Sometimes voices, sometimes actions, sometimes situations you find yourselves in, sometimes going, not what I thought, but what I got.
Yeah. And I think that in the prayer, this is why I included the comment, from Pilate, right? Who, it's so interesting, right? And he does what a lot of us do in prayer and in life, and he says, "What is truth?" And it's interesting that it didn't say he asked this, but it said he said. So he's talking to Jesus, and he's kind of making a statement saying, "What is truth?" And then as I wrote, he doesn't stick around for the answer. He doesn't open his heart. He doesn't consider. And when we don't stick around for the answer, we may not realize that when we don't really consider, and sometimes that consideration takes
years,
a day, a week, you know, a year, just to open up, to be present, to ask, and then, you know, kind of have this posture like this, which is why sometimes, you know, people actually physically even pray like this, in an open stance. Because if we're just saying things to God and then we are done our prayer and we go away, it doesn't really do us. It might check off a box, but it doesn't do us any good for soul food. And I'll just tell you, since there's about 2 minutes left here. Yeah, so I'll tell you, there's one time, you know, people say, you know, receiving an answer. There's only really one time in my life that I remember actually getting real words back. And that was, we were away for a whole summer. There were problems going on, even though we were away. It was 20 years ago, 22 years ago. And it was on a little sabbatical, but every single night I was having to deal with problems in my mind. And we all deal with this stuff at 2-3 in the morning. You know, my mind's going. And at one point I said, God, really, seriously, can I even just get away and, you know, and not have to think about this stuff? And I said, why am I getting up every night? And in a moment, words came back and it said, because this is when you were listening. And ever since then, it doesn't really bother me so much, the 3 in the mornings, because I realize, because this is when I'm listening. And sometimes that is an opportunity for God to come in. And sometimes it takes even hours for that to process.
Yeah. And I think for me, dreams are a big way that, and dreams are all over the Bible, way God speaks to God's people all throughout the Bible in dreams. And funny dreams, serious dreams, but so many of the answers come to me in some form through a dream.
Just quick, tell them about the dream about Aaliyah.
Yeah. So our daughter Aaliyah, reason why my voice is hoarse, we had her going away party last night. She's moving to London next week, which is very exciting. But when she was little, if any of you remember her, she was a ball of fire, she still is, ball of fire. She was a kid who pulled everything out of every cupboard, every book off the bookshelf, just wanted to touch, explore, see everything. And she just left destruction wherever she went throughout the house, just mass destruction. And I had a dream one night, and I was like, I was in a room, and there was clearly God at one end of the room, and I was here. And I was presenting in front of, like, a court. And I was saying, and then, you know, I don't know what to do with her, that she does this, and then she does this, and I yell at her, and it doesn't matter. She runs away laughing, and then I do this, and that kind of thing. And this God figure said, temper her with love. And I was like, no, I get that. Like, I love her, obviously. But then, and I went on and on. And this was one of those dreams that felt like it went on all night long. And the only response was, temper her with love. Temper her with love. Temper her with love. And the next morning I woke up and I said, okay, I got the message. I'm going to temper her with love. And we had the best day. And I completely switched the way I parented that child versus the other child that we had. So those messages, you know, can come. I didn't even know that I was asking the question, except I knew that I was very frustrated with her. And so that's how sometimes God answers you when you're not even really asking a question directly. Sometimes our prayers are just our thoughts that head on up there. All right, Paul, this one's yours. How do we square...
It's a softball.
No. This, because this is your sermon. How do we square the concept of contentment from previous sermons with the call to / need to act, such as to right injustice, to serve others in need, etc.?
Yeah, which is an ideal question. So I was talking a lot about contentment. And one of the things that is so important for us to realize is that contentment doesn't mean non-engagement with life, but in my understanding with it, because, you know, the Apostle Paul, who was incredibly active, he pushed and he challenged to the point of himself, you know, being killed and being executed. and he was always finding himself, you know, he goes through a list in one of his letters of, you know, he's, you know, I've been shipwrecked, I've been, you know, faced starvation, I've been imprisoned in chains and, you know, beaten by rods and so forth. And he goes down this whole list. But then he also says, fascinatingly, you know, I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. And you go, how on earth can you be content and to be pushing, you know, with, you know, social justice and issues? And, you know, what he was, what he, you know, his mission was conveying the truth of Christ and receiving the consequences of that. And so you hear your calling. And I would say, you know, people, well, how do I know what I'm passionate about? It's my experience that the things that upset you the most, have your own meter inside. Like, I just, you know, I just can't stand, you know, whatever issue that might be. You take, you know, when you peek out that meter, what your soul is telling you is that's what you care about the most. That's passion. Now, if you don't do anything about that, you're just kind of torturing yourself. So you're feeling deeply, you're experiencing passion, and again, not having an outlet for that is self-torture. I think that that's God speaking to you, saying, do something about it. You're equipped. You know, write letters, or protest, or right a wrong, or develop an invention, or, you know, whatever that may be. So take action. And the contentment, I think, is taking action but not doing it out of a sense of anger or vengeance. It's you're taking your action, your momentary actions, between now and your vision, your goal, your calling, and you're taking those steps and you're taking those actions. And even though there are, you know, physical, you know, consequences and so forth, and it takes effort, the contentment comes in the fact that you are following your purpose. And there is a great sense of well-being. There's a very powerful sense of well-being in that. Anyone who's ever accomplished anything of value in life, you know, they all agree that that it's working towards that that gives that sense of being, you know, feeling I've had a worthwhile life. And nobody will tell you I've had an easy life, but it's that sense of worthwhile.
I agree. I also think that we get wrapped up. There are so many things in the world that need our help that it almost becomes paralyzing. Mm-hmm. And so we lack contentment because we realize there are so many things in the world that need our help, and what, how are we going to do this, and what is this ever going to look like? Mm-hmm. But we're one person, and we have the power to be one person, or we have the power to join together with others and be many persons instituting change. And I think that's where we find our contentment, is finding that issue, or that, as you said, that thing that set your heart on fire, and then do that. And don't worry about the rest of the world, because there are other people who mm-hmm. care about other things who are going to be doing that. So you don't have to feel like you have to do it all and become paralyzed by that. Find that one thing. For me, it's the work on the reservation for us. That is that one thing. But even out there on the reservation, we have to narrow it to education. There is food insecurity, there is injustice, there is social injustice, there is abuse. Those are all issues. If I tried to take on all of those, we would do nothing out there. So we focus on the one. And it's very hard to tell someone who's hungry, I'm really sorry, we don't do food injustice, we do education type of thing. But you stick to what you do, and you make a drop in that puddle, and the ripples run out, and that's where you find your contentment. And I think the other thing, quick, is the happiness is not contentment. They're not the same. Yeah. So, yeah. But time's up, and nobody asked what's the difference between contentment and time. Do you believe that we return to the one after death, meaning there's no separate consciousness? Absolutely, 100%. That didn't even take more than 10 seconds. But I'm clergy, so yes, but, and if I said no, I think we'd all be in a problem at this moment right now. But yes, I believe we're born of one consciousness. When the Bible tells us God is love, love is an energy, that is the consciousness, that love energy is who we are and how we are connected with God. And Jesus himself very clearly said, in my Father's house there are many rooms. If it were not so, why would I tell you that? And I go to prepare a place for you. And when I go there, I will return and I will bring you there with me. That's a pretty bold and clear version of you don't just die and stay in the ground. There is some consciousness that moves you there. So theologically, that mine is based on that concept. And then science keeps backing it up. Even Alexander's book, all these near-death experiences of people all over the world who don't know about one or each other, who are having these experiences in which they are connected with people who have previously died, they are connected with a white light, they feel they're in a space of love like they've never experienced before. I mean, there is just an onslaught of evidence that this is not the end of the road.
Yeah. There are clearly so many connections between what we call like this life and the next, right? So it seems like there's something else, but when Laura was saying the science backing up, in my Father's house there are many rooms, and I understand that to be in terms of connecting with science. Because it's just all describing the same thing except using different language, science or theology or math or whatever, is the, and many of you have heard me say this before, but my Father's house, a house is a domain, right? So a domain is the whole of it, right? And the rooms are different, spaces, areas in that whole. And what science tells us now through physics, through quantum physics, is that there are most likely narrowed it down to 11 dimensions, right? So look it up, Google it, check out how many dimensions. We live in the four dimension, we live in the four dimensions, we live in the height, depth, width, which are three, and then time we experience as the fourth dimension. And then there are seven more. Scientists will tell you there's seven more. So when Jesus says, I go from this place, that we're leaving the four dimensions, and we don't need this, but there are non-physical, right? And it makes perfect sense that it's not really the next life so much as it's a continuum in a different form. And we go back and forth and we experience the form and the formless all the time in this life anyway. So it's experiencing life in a different way. And just a little mental exercise for you to do is that, all the things that we identify with ourselves in terms of kind of personality and identity markers in terms of, height, age, I'm 52 years old, I'm from Southport, Connecticut, I've went to this school and here's my job and so forth, and all these different markers. And you have this sense of self. Well, go back in time, go back to when you were 12 years old. Physically, you were completely different. You didn't have the education. You were probably in a different location. If you're a parent now, you didn't have children. You didn't have a spouse. You didn't have all these different things. And you go, well, yeah, I was still me. That was still definitely me. Now go back to when you were 5 years old. And you had even less education, less experiences, less wisdom, and you can still identify and you go, yeah, that was me. And you can go back and back and back. It's like, wait a minute, how are you you? How are you still the sense of you as a whole being that you can still identify and relate to when all these markers that we're so hung up on in terms of, how much money do we have and all this kind of stuff, when it wasn't there, we're still us. And so we, if you can keep going back, we realize that We're born with this sense of us, which is really soul, which really doesn't have to do with body type or age or education or any of these things. And so that kind of gives us a little bit of an inkling of, you know, that's how we start. We drop the body, we continue. So it's one way to look at it.
Yeah, and taking that a little further, because we do this with confirmation class, is that taking it back even to when were you born? Everyone's going to tell me the day and year that they were born. I'm like, really? Is that when you were born? And they're like, oh, no, 9 months earlier. You know, yep. But is that really when you were born? Did you not exist in some form prior to the moment of conception? Actually, you did. You lived in DNA, and you know, I'm not going to do that lesson, but you know where you live. And then you've lived through your mothers and your fathers and your mother's mothers and your father's fathers, and you've lived for eternity because nothing, something cannot come from nothing. So there has to have always been something. And if there's always been something, what is that something? It's for you, you to decide, right? Okay. After having lost your spouse, the love of your life, your best friend, how does one move on, embracing and enjoying life once again without feeling guilty about your happiness and the possibility of sharing your life's journey with a new partner?
Yeah.
It's a good question.
I have not lost my spouse. I lost my mom when she was very young, and I've talked about that a lot. So first of all, I want to say, I don't know, and I don't look forward to finding out. I don't. I really don't. That is a pain. That, like so many things in the world, that is a pain that I don't want to find out how well I deal with it, okay? That being said, in having processed this, you know, myself, and as I think about a lot of things, and with so many people, one of the things that I think is most helpful is to consider, how would that person want me to live? And I know, and we've talked about this, if I die, I want you to live and love and relate and enjoy. No, you know, I do.
No.
I do. I mean, will you be sad? Yes. Would it gratify me in any way if you stopped living and stopped, you know, sharing fully? It's like, no, I mean, absolutely not. Because this is this four-dimensional, this is a short gift. And I don't want you to waste it. You know, I want you to make the most of it, right? And so, you know, knowing that, I mean, that's what I would remember. You know, if Laura died, I would go, you know, what would you want for me? And, you know, if we were able to talk about it, I mean, like if I knew that I had something, that's what I would tell you.
Right.
Yeah.
And we talk about it, yeah. And you should talk about it, because that's a good, right? That answers that question. And people don't often, you know, take that time. There's a great book called The Final Gift. Make sure you fill one out. We have here at church that answers those questions so that people know, of course, the person you love wants you to continue on living. I've yet to meet a person who says, I love my spouse so much that when I die, I want them to do nothing with the rest of their life except mourn me. I've never heard anyone ever say that. And I think that great love brings about great grief that is healed by great love. So we need to go through that cycle, and we need to love again in order to become whole again. And I don't think there's anyone in the world who would not want their spouse to be whole again.
And I'll just say, I mean, with that, does that mean it's not awkward? No. It would be awkward. I think it would be uncomfortable. There would have to be a lot of talking to yourself in the process. It's always a bizarre feeling to be grieving and then experience joy, and you go, wait a minute, how can I be experiencing joy when I should be, you know, sad? I should be like wrecked with grief and so forth. And yet that's a part of it. That's part of really living in the moment, living in the gift. You experience the grief, yes. You experience the joy, yes. And it's not, you're not doing a tribute to the person by not experiencing the joy too, right?
I had a really good thought, you guys. Oh, I know what it was. If you're a person of faith and you believe that your loved one has died and is living in perfect love with God, how amazing is that, right? Your loved one is the happiest your loved one has ever been, no matter how fabulous your marriage was. And you deserve that same. Like, they're not going to enjoy being with God because they feel badly that you're left here on earth, right? That's the movement forward. And our job is to move forward as well. And I think that, I think that without feeling guilty about your happiness and the possibility of sharing your life's journey with a new partner, I think, you know, just sometimes we have to do some hard work after a spouse has died too, because no marriage is perfectly perfect. So what are we carrying with us that might be stopping us from taking that next step to be able to live fully and lovingly again? And, you know, that might just be something that, you know, a couple sessions with a good therapist can help, which I think everybody should do when they lose someone that they love, because it's I'm a huge advocate for therapy at any time and all time. I think it's the best thing that's been invented by humanity. So, but love is never a wrong thing in my book. Just can't be wrong. Okay, there's so many good ones. The difference between Son of God and Son of Man in Jesus Christ, how can he be both? Good theological question.
It's a great theological question. And people have wrestled with this one. The great thing about doctrine is that doctrine wasn't written on stone and just kind of landed from the heavens on earth and hit the ground and, you know, it's like there it is that there are theologians, they've tried to wrestle with these issues of, you know, who was Jesus. And in the Gospels, so one Gospel writer, and I can't remember who's who, I used to in exams in seminary, but so one tends to refer to Jesus as Son of God, one tends to refer to Jesus as Son of Man, and you can go through and you can read and can compare. And it's really kind of a matter of emphasis. It's the question of, you know, was he the whole fully divine and fully human question. Was Jesus fully human? Yes, absolutely. And theologians have dealt with this one. Was he actually crucified? Did he actually suffer? It wasn't just a show, you know, and that he wasn't feeling these things and he's going, and then, you know, but not really experiencing them. He was experiencing every single bit of it. But then, was he fully divine? Yeah, he was. I mean, he was fully divine by being a conduit, a messenger of God. They say the revelation of God. Was he the revelation of God? What does that mean? He's revealing God. He's revealing God cleanly, clearly, so that you can understand in a very pure way what God is about. And so in that way, it's coming through this conduit, you know, pure without filters. And each one of us have filters, and we have, we have biases and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it came through him without these biases. So that's the Son of God part. And then the Son of Man is the Son of Man. And he had to figure things out, you know, also like we do. And one of the ways I'll just say quickly that I think of him is as a spiritual savant. And we go, oh, come on, how could somebody be, you know, just like have that clear of a conduit to God. It's like, I don't know, how can you go to somebody and say, what was the weather on March 13th, 1924? And he'll tell you, and he's exactly right. Or you can say, you know, what day of the week was April 23rd, you know, 1914, and they'll go, Tuesday, it was a Tuesday. And you go, how do you do that, right? So people have extraordinary, extraordinary gifts. If you can do that with math problems, you know, you can give some human beings crazy math problems and they'll spit it out faster than a computer. How do you do that? I don't know. How do you spit out God, you know, just and be that conduit? I don't know. But if people can do it with math, with art, with days of the week, with weather, with all sorts of things, why not, in the course of humanity, can someone be that clear conduit for God and just tell you and lay it out and have that kind of knowledge and understanding?
I think also when you're reading the Gospels, you need to pay attention, literally, to who the audience is that the gospel writer is writing to, because they're writing to very different audiences. And so, you know, if they're writing to a Jewish audience, they're going to talk about Jesus being the Son of God because they are looking for the Messiah to come. If they are Luke, who's a doctor, who is writing his gospel, he's going to refer to God, to Jesus as the Son of Man, because he's saying, look, this flesh and blood was here and performed medical miracles that nobody else has been able to ever do. So there's also a context part of when you're reading the Bible. You really need to know who they're writing to, what their intention is, what's their purpose in writing their gospel. And then that helps you to understand those two conversation sides.
Yeah. Good. Easy. Let me do one more last question.
Okay. So it's a hard question to talk about in church, but it is a question that is on everyone's mind. So I'm going to go with the hard, difficult one. Which is based on your understanding of Jesus' teachings, what do you believe his thoughts would be on abortion?
Well, I see we're out of time.
So. You know, and it's live stream, and it will live forever on YouTube. But I will start for just a moment, and I get that you're saying based on your understanding of Jesus' teachings, but I feel very uncomfortable trying to discern what Jesus would say about something that wasn't part of what he ever spoke about. And unfortunately, there are so many things that Jesus never got to speak about that are social issues today. Homosexuality, sexuality, abortion, you know, all these, there are so many. But I got to go with what was his number one message at all times. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. This is the greatest commandment. And then you have to say, what is love? Right? What is the definition of love? And that's where we all get mucked up. Is that life? Is that conception? Is that, what is that? And is terminating a pregnancy a loving thing to do? Of course, there are many situations, and that is the only thing that can be done. So is there, and then, you know, there's the other side. So I would hesitate to even go to what Jesus, I think Jesus would want, except I think we always need to think about love as the ultimate end. And so what is the end in those situations?
So that's and it's really interesting. So with all the different situations that Jesus found himself, the one consistent, and I would say the only consistent, was always exercising love in whatever situation. Now the interesting thing is, I don't see it, and it wasn't. It was never one size fits all. He dealt with very, very complex issues, and sometimes he seemed to contradict himself by those who said, well, wait a minute, you did one thing here, why don't you always do that one thing with everybody everywhere? We as human beings seek out simple answers, for sometimes complex issues and complex questions. And that is, to me, that's a cop-out, and it's just not theologically correct. For example, you know, he said, you know, when divorce came up, he said, you know, that you know, not only is divorce wrong, but you can't even think about, you know, you can't even think about it, right? So you go, okay, well, I got it. All divorce is wrong in all situations, and that's, you know, that's a judgment against God. And then, but then he deals with a woman who has been, you know, who had five husbands, right? Had five husbands. Okay, so what's the response to her? Well, obviously it's condemnation, right? For all the horrible things that she did. And you go, no, that wasn't his response. That wasn't his response to this person who, you know, did something that he just said, but you just said. It was all wrong in every instance. Like, no, because the greater, there's the law, and then the thing that supersedes the law is the law of love. And that's what he did differently than the Jewish tradition. Jewish tradition is locked in law. And another example of that is healing on the Sabbath. And people say, you know, such and such is wrong because it says in the Old Testament, you know, homosexuality is wrong. It says it in the Old Testament. It's very clear. It's like, well, it also says the Ten Commandments. And one of those Ten Commandments is you honor the Sabbath, which means you don't work on the Sabbath, period. That is just as much as a law as, you know, not lying or stealing, anything else. You don't work on the Sabbath. So when he was healing on the Sabbath, there were people who, legal experts, who jumped down his throat saying, you are crossing the line of one of the Ten Commandments. But the reason why he healed was for the human factor, was for the love in this situation. And this situation called for love and medical action to relieve this person's suffering in this situation. And so he's saying, this is how you do it. Situational ethics is what he gave us. Which, is that complex? You bet it's complex. Is it something that the only way that you can deal with that is through complete integrity and asking and genuinely seeking, what does God want for this situation? Does that vary from person to person, situation to situation? I'm not going to give you my answer. I'll give you Jesus's answer. Read Healing on the Sabbath, and you tell me what that says about situational ethics. Okay? And to me, that has to do with abortion. Is it difficult? Are there different situations? Is it, you know, one issue if, you know, somebody's using it for random birth control, and another person's I'll give you the example of the 10-year-old who's raped. That's in the news. I think they're different situations. So, but seek, as we wrap up, Jeremiah, you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. What is truth? We don't just ask the question, check off the box, and walk away. Let's honor Christ a lot more than that. Right. That's the gift. That's the challenge. That's the live issue of faith in all of our lives. May we take this gift, this power, this privilege, and use it well.
And I think, too, let's circle right back to the very first question, conversation with God. All of these questions are great conversations for you to have with God. Mm. They are all great, especially the last one. Great conversation for you to have with God, and then sit and listen and work with God to discern the answer.